Support for the Media Project comes from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a new Bachelor of Science degree in public health with a focus on social, physical, and behavioral sciences. strose.edu. From Northeast Public Radio, this is the Media Project, a weekly discussion about issues confronting the media.
Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime, and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
So why not start the Media Project now? Give our listeners an opportunity for a half hour of analysis and commentary, and if we're lucky, some insight into the news media issues of the week. That's what we say. I'm Rex Smith, editor of the Times Union, here with Dr. Alan Shartok, the CEO of Northeast Public Radio. There he is. Here with Kaylin Brown, the head of the communications department at the College of St. Rose. How you do?
Good day.
Good day, mate. Indeed. It's wonderful to be here. Dr. Shartok, you are with us, aren't you? Well, not quite. Not as much as you may think, anyway.
I remember doing a show with Mario Cuomo once, and at the very beginning of the show, he said, okay, listen, I'm not happy with you, so I'm not going to say a single word during the thing. And for the first 10 minutes, he had me in hysterics. He would not say a word.
Well, you know, those were the good old days. So we have a little piece of mail. You all can, by the way, offer your thoughts. It's a question, actually, from Tom in Johnstown, who says, hello, Alan Rex et al. Hi, Al.
Hey. I'll be Al.
You can call me Al. Okay. Why do you think it took 2 weeks for the story of the search of Manafort's home to reach the public? Interesting question, of course, that having to do with Paul Manafort, the former Trump campaign manager whose home back in July was searched by the FBI in a pre-dawn raid. And the question is, why didn't we know about it at the time?
Was it July 26th,
I think they searched it.
Mm-hmm. Because, you know, my birthday was on July 25th.
My daughter's birthday as well, you know.
Really?
Oh, isn't that something?
Isn't that
She's a good person.
Isn't that true?
So anyway, you know, I think everybody was just tired, all the reporters, from celebrating my birthday.
What do you think about the fact that the crackdown on leaks is actually working? People were so afraid that they didn't share any information about the fact Manafort's home had been raided by the FBI.
This is true. Also, one of the most difficult places in the world to get information from is the FBI. I mean,
right,
this notion of getting leaks from the FBI, there are lots of law enforcement agencies who, and we should talk about leaks as a big part of this program, but there are lots of law enforcement agencies that will share information. The FBI is notoriously silent.
They are. They're a professional organization and they know the rules, and you know, and they don't do that. That gives you a lot of confidence in them. A lot of times leaks have to do with who's on the rack. What I mean by that is I have this theory that the two guys who President Trump is thinking may take the full brunt of the heat here are Flynn and Manafort, and that they will be the poster boys for this entire investigation as opposed to anything reaching the president. There's a theory, by the way, that if Manafort and Flynn could be flipped to testify, because they know a lot to testify, or they're thought to know a lot about Trump and his dealings over there. So you put pressure on. Now, leaks are often done by people who have some business to do one way or another. So when you take a look at this, you say, okay, who would have stood to benefit by letting out the news that this thing happened? I mean,
That would be probably the president, right? If your theory is that Manafort is somebody who they're hoping will take the fall and the president won't, so maybe somebody close to the president would have let this word out.
Could be.
Mm-hmm. Oddly, why did it take so long for the FBI to raid his house? Manafort's been in the news since Ukraine days, and all of his efforts on that front. So why has it taken so long? I mean, by now, wouldn't he have scrubbed everything?
Well, it was the day after his testimony before right. Congress. And so it could be that they heard something that suggested to them that they had to quickly get to a judge and get the warrant. You know, this required showing actually the real potential that there was a crime committed here for a judge to sign the warrant. So, but I was actually surprised that I don't know what neighborhood Manafort's home is in Washington, but homes tend to be packed in kind of tightly in D.C., and it makes you wonder if the neighbors didn't, how could they not have noticed if there are all these FBI agents coming in and carting out stuff, and how come they didn't
tell us? It was literally in the middle of the night, by the way.
Yeah, yeah.
It's very interesting. There was this guy, a congressman, I think his name was Jefferson, wasn't it, who was caught. And they came in and they did such a search, and allegedly they found a ton of money in his freezer of his...
Cold cash, so to speak.
in a freezer. And that got out real fast that they found that stuff. So what's of some concern to me is you hear about a Manafort raid, but you don't hear what they came away with or whether they got anything.
That's harder because after a search warrant is executed, those who actually obtain the information have to file a return, reporting back to the court that issued the search warrant what they got. And some courts will release the search warrant return so that you can actually find out what was seized. Some will not. But that's actually a great reporting technique, is to find out, is to get the search warrant return from the court. But in the case of an FBI search with a search warrant signed by a federal judge, I don't think you're going to get that return. I don't think we'll get any clear accounting of what was actually seized until long, long from now.
Well, I think back to your question about which neighborhood he lived in, we do know that he made a great deal of money working in the Ukraine theater and in the Turkish theater and other places. I wouldn't worry about his living in a kind of place where, you know, his house was too crowded in with others.
No, actually, that's not true. I mean, I was just a couple weeks ago walking upon the occasion of celebrating my daughter's birthday, as a matter of fact, speaking of the date, walking through the neighborhood where the Obamas and the Kushners live in Washington. And, you know, the homes are very close together, the Kalorama neighborhood there. Even though they're beautiful big mansions, they're kind of
tight.
Which
may raise the question of, how come Michelle didn't pick up the phone and say, you know, somebody's raiding
Manafort? What's going on here? So we talked about cracking down on leakers. It is true that the Justice Department, Jefferson Beauregard Sessions, the Attorney General of the United States, said the Department of Justice is open for business, and I have this morning this warning, don't do it. For the past several months, we have made changes and are seriously ramping up our efforts. He's talking about the intelligence community, leaks from the intelligence community. Which is a different thing from, I mean, there are different kinds of leaks, you know.
Including from the chief executive of the United States.
Absolutely.
Who is supposed to be one of the big leakers of all times.
Of course. I mean, when a person calls a reporter and says, let me tell you about something, that is a leak, I suppose, if it's not an authorized press release. If there were no leaks, you know, you wouldn't have half the news that you are able to obtain.
Well, I am a huge fan of those who
leaks.
I really
yes.
am, because I think that they're the ones who give out the news. And Rex and I have argued many times about what investigative reporting is. And one of the things that I've always said is investigating reporting is when somebody calls you up on the telephone and leaks into your ear.
This is such baloney. You have no clue what investigative reporting is if you really believe that.
But if an individual calls a reporter to share information from the federal government,
right.
so a federal employee, the fact that call happens doesn't make that call a leak. Is that what you're arguing?
Yeah, that's why. Trump actually attacks yeah. anything that is not issued by his office
officially
as being a leak.
Sanctioned.
That's true, right?
Yeah.
Which is a different matter from intelligence community leaks, right?
Indeed, it is. There's a different criteria there and a different level of secrecy. Still, I think a lot of reporters who interact with sources would not say a source calling them on the phone is leaking anything.
Absolutely.
So I think that's the best way to share information is a reporter talking with a source.
You know, so when James Comey testified before Congress after he was fired, he explained that he had instructed a friend, I believe a law professor at Columbia, to leak his account of the conversation he had had with President Trump to a reporter at the Times.
I want to go back to your sneering, condescending.
It wasn't. It was just an accurate statement.
No,
you have no clue what investigative reporting is. If you think that it's all about leaks, then you have never seen an investigative reporter at work.
You always know when somebody has got a vulnerable position when they won't let the other guy when they won't let the other guy talk. And I'm here to tell you. So let me ask you a question, Rex. You did graduate first in your class. Columbia Law School. So I want to ask
journalism. I didn't go to law school. Thank you. It's very kind of you.
Okay, so was the Pentagon Papers, were they a leak?
The Pentagon Papers were, in fact, a leak, yes.
And so somebody got great credit for that story, didn't they?
Yeah, but that's not investigative reporting.
Well, you know, now we're just carping and
no, we're
around,
not.
Around the
it's
edge.
A big
we're
difference when a reporter
all.
Starts
okay.
digging
no, no, no,
and
what,
digging.
What Rex is going to say.
You're just making up words. You're just saying investigative. You are dissing every investigative reporter who has ever spent months and months on a story digging stuff out.
Yeah,
that is not just somebody picking up a phone and calling him. It is taking documents. I spent 11 months on a story once.
And did it go anywhere?
Did it go anywhere? What do you mean? Did it go anywhere? Did I become famous like you? No. But
you're famous now because you're on the show. We all know that. But I want to ask you a question here. So the Pentagon Papers was a leak, and it was considered to be a major story, right? Now, you do a lot of stories all the time, and you say, okay, how many particulates are in a quarter of an ounce of water coming out of the Hudson River? And that's an investigative story because the reporter is working very hard on that. Right, Rex?
I don't know. That could have been investigative. Investigative reporting, typically. I mean, we could bring in an investigative reporting professor to give you some lessons here if you'd like.
I don't need any lessons, Rex.
Pick me.
There you go.
So our students are frequently filing Freedom of Information requests. That is a proactive stance when a reporter chooses to seek information and documents to support his or her work. That kind of work is absolutely investigative and usually results in additional FOIs. That's happening right now with students in between semesters at St. Rose. So that is a form of investigative reporting, constantly seeking more sources, verification, why people are saying what they're saying. All of that constitutes investigative journalism, even on something as small as a city council meeting where an offhanded comment is made and a reporter who's at that council meeting decides to pursue that story.
So now I know why only 10%, based on, you know, your defensiveness, why only 10% of the people in America admire the media.
Why is that?
What do you mean? What, did you just wake up?
But it's admirable.
You're very defensive.
It is
you're
admirable.
You're very defensive about terms and this and that. I'm just saying some of the best stories that have led to further investigative reporting have come because somebody picks up a telephone.
I think that's true. Sometimes leaks make a big difference. We don't disagree about that. I'm just disagreeing that you dissed investigative reporting by saying investigative reporting is just picking up a phone.
No, you...
We'll go back and check the tape, as Mario used to say.
You're the disser.
No dissing.
No dissing now. Anyway, back to leaks, because there are a lot of things, as Alan points out correctly, there are things that we would never have known if it were not for leaks like the Pentagon Papers, and that the government was furious at the time. Barack Obama was no friend of leaks. He was very much aggressive through his Department of Justice. Remember, it was the Justice Department under Obama that pursued Edward Snowden, who leaked the information about surveillance practices to the Washington Post.
And Ronald Reagan, by the way, famously, and I believe it was on NPR that I heard this, maybe the Beeb, was at a press conference that I was going to release something today, but I'm waiting till it was leaked because it'll get more headlines that way.
Well, you know, there is something to that, and that is reporters tend to give more attention to something that they've worked hard on and dug out than something that is just dumped on them. Don't you think that's true?
I believe reporters prefer to do enterprise reporting and investigative reporting generated from them. And that's what we talk about in the classroom, that the best stories come from the ones you identify yourself. And perhaps it's through sourcing or regular use of your sources. But absolutely, journalists prefer to find the story themselves. That's always been my experience.
Well, the wonderful Delmer C. Dunn, who wrote Politicians in the Press, he said sometimes, and one of the best books ever written by this.
I've never heard of this before.
Nor have I.
Delmer C. Dunn.
You guys should basically go to the library. I can tell you where that is. And you can look up Delmer C. Dunn, Public Officials in the Press is the name of it.
It's probably
it is out of print. And I begged him for years to do it again. What he did was he went to public officials, politicians, and he said, what do you expect out of reporters? And then he went to reporters and said, what do you expect out of politicians? And some of the things that came out were terrific. For example, one of the things that he found was ease of coverage became a very important criteria.
Ease of coverage.
Ease of coverage. In other words, how easy is this story going to be? Do I want to kill myself? do I want to kill myself doing it? So you... two people who are very pompous and very condescending, are always talking about how hard reporters work.
Mm-hmm.
Good reporters. Absolutely. There are lazy humans mm-hmm. in every form of work.
Do you know,
work.
Would you rather have to work really hard or have an easier time? What would you think?
You
I'm just asking. I mean,
you
human beings
now.
Rather like
exactly
to have
the kind
a smoother
of
road.
Cheap stuff I'm talking about that I have to endure while I'm
on the subject of the library, as recently as yesterday, the Albany Public Library online for me via email and telephone dug up a very old story from the Times Union that I needed to get access
mm-hmm.
to.
Nice.
Went into their microfiche and copied it, scanned it, and got it to me so I can use it for my studies this semester.
That's
so
great.
The library is a super resource, and I'm grateful to the Albany Public Library
that
for all they
great.
Do.
That is great. That's Kaylin Brown from the College of St. Rose, Dr. Ellen Shartok from Northeast Public Radio, and I'm Rex Smith from the Times Union. This is the Media Project from Northeast Public Radio. If you wish to be a part of the program, you can send your views to us the way Tom in Johnstown did, who asked a question that started this whole discussion. That is media@wamc.org, and we'll be happy to hear what you have to say. So Ellen was talking about ease of coverage. You know, one of the ways that you are able to cover politicians, public officials, is by they stand up and tell you things, and then you have to question them, and you have to dig further and find out if what they told you is true. But press conferences are a traditional part of the way people execute their work as public officials. Donald Trump has broken a record on press conferences that is 64 years old. He's had just one solo press conference since he took office 200 days ago, now more than 200 days. And every president since Dwight Eisenhower has held more press conferences than Trump at this point. I think he's afraid. I think he doesn't know what he's doing well enough, and he's afraid to talk to reporters.
I have to agree with Rex on this once again. If he were able to get up in front, I do. I absolutely do. This president has made clear that he is unclear about his duties, and he is unable to get up in front of anyone and speak coherently and describe what his purpose is, what the agenda is for the administration, the particular stance they are taking on anything from North Korea to Russia. He has an inability to communicate that. And so why would they organize a press conference to have an individual stand in front of the press with an inability to share his views?
Don, I sort of agree with you. But to take the other side for a moment, his side, which I hate to do, but since you guys are, you know, a howling chorus of coyotes, I thought I would at least try to get inside this man's head, which is he truly believes, right? I think we all agree on this, that he truly believes that the press are out to get him and that they are not friends of his. And as you know, he has now got this new online thing where he puts a very attractive person up. You see, I didn't say woman, but it is a woman in this case.
Right.
See, and she says, on the good side, the stock market is up. Oh. The thing is up. The this is up. The that is up. And therefore, you know, he's convinced that the press is out to get him. And they are.
I disagree with that, too. I don't know that he's actually convinced of that, because you earlier just said he believes. I don't know that he believes anything.
Hey, Kaylin, this is the Shartakian test, which is if you put the lie detector cuff on his arm and you said, is the press out to get you? And he said, yes. Would you get a wavy line for a lie, or would you get a straight line? You'd get a straight line for sure.
Well, you know, he was, before he ran for president, one of the most press-friendly guys around. He did everything he could to cultivate relationships with reporters, and he still...
He lied, called him up, and pretend he was other people.
All the time. You know, pretended to be his own spokesman and talk about Trump in the third person. I mean, but he lies the way he eats supper.
He equates his constituency with audience, and audience is something the media thinks about, yes? But it maybe isn't necessarily what a politician should be thinking about. What a constituency needs or deserves is different than what an audience needs or deserves. And he does not separate those two things. He sees his constituency as an audience to be performed in front of. So attacking the media serves his audience and him.
Especially when, as I said before, public perception of the media is so poor.
Yes, although but your number was off, by the way. It's about 24% still hold the media in fairly high regard. So
depends what you're looking at, Rex.
Well, but it's true. And I think that it applies to all of us in this room, Alan. As long as you are, you know, the head of this massive public radio network here, you are part of the media. And
as
so,
Mario Cuomo would say, I deny it.
So, but of course, all institutions are under attack. What, the nihilism of the American people, we can talk about. But aside from that, you know, and part of it, you could say it may be true that there is one of the things that you've always argued is that we are elitist. And that is a conservative assessment of the media. Trump supporters are saying the problem with the media is that we are more elitist. The accusation from the podium at the press briefing recently, where there was this extraordinary exchange between CNN's Jim Acosta and Stephen Miller, the 31-year-old presidential advisor, who finally hurled this epithet at CNN that you are cosmopolitanism. You know, cosmopolitanism, my goodness. And I don't know quite what the flip side of that is. Ignorance, perhaps. But it is basically accusing the media of being, elitist. Well, here's one, a professor at Claremont McKenna College, Frederick Lynch, who's a government professor, wrote in a Times op-ed that the issue, he says, I think much of the press has been very politically correct on affirmative action and diversity, immigration, and the white, middle, and working class. There's an elite class bias. But what about that?
Well, ask yourself this, Rex. Who does the New York Times hire? They hire the best of the best. They hire people who went to important places, important colleges, and they, right?
Yeah.
Every time Caitlin takes off her glasses, it means you're going to get it. And she just did.
Well, what is elitism? Someone who's educated, that makes them elite? I disagree with that equation there. I don't think that's accurate. And I think employers in any field want to hire someone who's the best at what they do or hope to get them to be the best. So that doesn't...
So you don't think there's any ethos, Professor, among those people who hold positions of distinction in the United States? There's a common agreement among them that, you know, that this is the way that world should be organized?
So there was a program called The Wire.
Mm-hmm.
And in The Wire, we had drug dealers and we had police officers. And there was an ethos in each of those subgroups.
Correct.
And my favorite character, whose name escapes me now, with a scar down his face, who's an amazing character, had an extraordinary ethos throughout that show, The Wire. He was a drug dealer. He was a murderer. He was a bad, bad dude. But he was also tied to completely this ethical framework that he believed in completely and totally. His grandmother, you don't shoot anybody around my grandmother on a Sunday when she's dressed in her Sunday best. So there are
right.
different levels of ethical frameworks under which people operate.
Okay, don't get me wrong. Just for whatever it's worth, I do think that the New York Times is the best newspaper in the world. And I do think that, you know, and I read it 3 times a day, maybe 5, in terms of finding out what's happened. And they do hire the best of the best. But, of course, Trump plays to a base which resents all of that, which is, what do we hear? What's his number one group of people? Non-college white men graduates, right?
So to that extent, it's probably an accurate assessment because the press really does need to work in the realm of fact, right? And
right.
fact is, in some of these issues, fact is derived from science, and Trump is speaking with an aversion to science and often an aversion to fact. And if that is elitism, then I don't know what else you can do.
Hey, Rexy, the one thing I do know about you is that, and we've had many conversations about this, is that you believe that if somebody is going to be a reporter covering a community, they should probably have access to that community. And very frequently, you're looking for people of color. You're looking for people who may not be the same as every other white upper class graduate of an institution, right?
I think you make I know what point you're going at. And therefore, we need to have more reporters who are able to relate to those people who don't have respect for science. In fact, It's a hard thing to do. I think you're right. We need to have reporters who reflect the diversity of the community, and that means people who can relate to Donald Trump supporters, and we may not have been so good at that because we're hiring too many people who look like me.
That would be white.
Yeah, you look like you and me, both guys 6 feet tall.
Newsrooms for a long, long time have had a challenge in trying to diversify their employment pool. I believe they keep trying to diversify. I think that in the classroom, our classrooms are absolutely evolving. So, the president is not
all wrong on this point, I guess that's it. On that point, we're going to have to call off the media project for this week. Kaitlin Brown, Alan Shartok, and Rex Smith, thanks for joining us.
Funny, Wall Street never has complained.
The Media Project is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. Alan Shartok is CEO of WAMC, Professor Emeritus at the State University of New York, commentator, columnist, and author. Rex Smith is editor of the Times Union. And Kaitlin Brown is the chair of the Department of Communications at the College of St. Rose. You can listen to or podcast The Media Project anytime at WAMC.org or just download the WAMC app for your iPhone or Android at the Play Store today. Thanks for listening.